From SDPB Radio, I'm Chris Lawfrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Now, if you're a fan of books, this week's Arts Podcast is for you. We start with pastor and author Arianne Braithwaite Lane, who says every person is a pilgrim journeying to a sacred place. Her own journey has included both celebration and loss. She grew up in Sioux Falls and decided to go to law school, that is, until God nudged her toward ministry. Now she celebrates the launch of a new book called Ash and Starlight, Prayers for the Chaos and Grace of Daily Life. In it, she offers prayers both contemplative and honest, prayers for centering, prayers for waiting, prayers for struggle. She met with In the Moment host Lori Walsh.
Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's such a gift to be here, Lori. Thank you so much for this privilege.
And you've had such a great homecoming in Sioux Falls at Zambros at First Presbyterian Church, where you were baptized, maybe even?
Yes. People said they remember me coming in a stroller, so it's been many years.
And this is a book of grounding material in the beginning and the end, but largely the content of it is prayer.
Yes.
And it has meant so much to me to sort of, because prayer is one of those things, it's kind of easy to pray for, you know, safe journey. We have got a storm coming through.
Right.
Pray for a loved one, God to watch over them. But there's a lot more there's a lot more possibilities to prayer. Talk to me about prayer formation. Is that something that you first kind of came upon in seminary? Is that something you've always sort of like thought about? How do we pray?
Prayer for me, my understanding of it has changed and grown, I would say, throughout the years. But the writing of prayers myself started about 8 years ago when I was in my last year of seminary and was doing some work at a church in northern Chicago, and I started every week writing a prayer that I would send out to our congregation on Fridays. And in this prayer, I would include the different prayer requests that people had given me during the week and would incorporate those in a longer prayer to guide and hold our hearts for the day. And my hope with that was to both cultivate our prayer life as a community, but also breed a little bit more vulnerability with one another. Mm. And an unexpected gift for me in writing prayers was how that uncovered my writing voice and my inner voice in fresh ways. And I started to see how prayer can be a way to simply hold what we're already feeling in the presence of God, just to be aware of the ways that God is holding us and our experiences and our raw and messy emotions right in the moment. And so this practice of writing prayers is something that just stuck. I continued on with that when my spouse, Jeff, and I moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and started serving a church together there. I continued to write prayers with the congregation. And then when I stepped away from my parish call in 2015, that's when I began my blog and continued to write prayers there. And it's interesting for me to look at my prayers over the years and just see how the experiences that I was having at the time of writing them are embedded in them and were a way for me to make some meaning and to find some integration and wholeness in what seemed to be the great paradoxes of my life, great joy and great grief.
Yeah. We see, I mean, most of us who have grown up in church or really even, you know, had any glancing familiarity with the Bible, we see people in the Bible, you know, raging against God, celebrating and honoring God, and also saying, why did you do this?
Yeah.
But we sometimes can forget that they're real people because we're looking at the big picture Bible story. What does it mean for us today? These are human beings having an intensely human experience and connecting with the divine. Why does it matter that we still... And I want to talk about this. This Chalice Press is part of a series of young female clergy.
Yes.
You know, bringing those voices out into the world. You're part of this series, according to the back of the book. the idea of people telling these stories now, not just what's in the pages of the Bible, but current, current writers expressing their prayers and their prayerfulness. What do you think? Why do you think that's important right now?
Well, going back to what you said about the biblical writers, the Psalms is my favorite book of the Bible for that very reason, because it's getting to the heart of expressing what's most authentic and what's within us. And I think we need that type of writing and expression right now, because that is what is going to keep us alive and awake to the Spirit of God at work in our world and within our own hearts. Mm-hmm. I think we're in a time of a lot of division, and what I see prayer doing is bringing things together in wholeness, is stitching it together, saying everything belongs. My anger and my rage belongs. Mm-hmm. My pain belongs. My questions belong. And so I think that remembering, like you said, that these people from the Bible are human can really free us in our own connections with God, as we see that we are part of a much larger story that began before us and is going to continue after us.
How did the process of, keeping a notebook and trying, showing up on the page and, in your busy life, you're a mother, you work, you have to eat, you have to do the things that the rest of us have to do, pay bills. Tell me about the process of kind of keeping track of what you wanted to say. And did that change into more prayerful living because you were paying attention and open to this,
what will the next attention. Yeah. That's exactly it, Lori. The paying attention is what writing helps me do. So for as long as I can remember, I've kept a notebook, and they're all in a Rubbermaid. I hope nobody discovers them. But I have just jotted down thoughts, things I hear, things I'm thinking about. And the way that I've done that has changed, but especially right now in this season when we have a 2- and a 5-year-old at home and we're totally in the weeds, I keep that notebook in our kitchen and I just jot down, they're literally sentences or single words that come to me during the day. And then when I do have more space to string together a few thoughts, I can go to that place, that notebook, and expound upon some idea that's resonating in my heart at that time. But I really think that writing things down is what helps me stay alive and awake to what's happening, that helps me keep meaning or find meaning even in places that it's hard for me to find meaning, and to realize that there is always something happening in my heart. Even these times when I might open up my notebook and I think, I don't have anything to say, or I come to a time when I could write and don't think that I have anything that I'm inspired about, it's amazing what can bubble up when we simply just be still.
Yeah. How do you think people will use this book? I know I said to you before we came on the air, I'm going to carry it in my purse, and every time I'm at a function where somebody says, who wants to pray? And everybody goes, I don't know, because nobody knows what to say or doesn't want to do it. I'm just going to say, pick a prayer, and we'll read what Marianne has to say. But how do you sort of anticipate this being part of people's lives?
Well, I've heard from people so far that they've used it in personal devotion, that a number of parents I know have used it with their kids, that it's been used in small groups and in church studies. And I hope it is a book that can be a springboard for people in expressing their own prayers. And it's a place to rest when you're feeling an emotion and trying to find words to express that. But then also in the back of the book, we've intentionally created some pages, some space that are titled My Ash and Starlight. And they're blank pages that give room for a reader to write down what they need to express and what's the ash and the starlight in their own lives that they're wrestling with.
What's your advice to those people who say, well, I couldn't, you know, how do I start? Where would you start writing your own, you know, sort of prayers down?
I think you start with what you're feeling in that moment. And it can be as simple as, God, I am feeling this. Or, God, this happened. And of course, God knows these things. But this is the act of naming it, I think, has such power. And when you start with just a simple emotion or experience, I think you can be surprised with what you're able to say about that or what comes after that. But that's where I would start, is even if it's one sentence, start there and write that down and see what that looses in you.
Yeah. We mentioned, and if you're just joining us, our guest is Arianne Braithwaite Lane, and her new book is called Ash and Starlight, and we should talk about the title of that. You have a beautiful introduction where you sort of illustrate that from your real life. Do you want to tell that story now?
Right. So when I was 31 weeks pregnant with our first child, my father, Tom Braithwaite, had a sudden and very serious relapse of his cancer. And what we didn't know was that he was going to die very quickly after that. And I was ministering and living in Indiana at the time and came back to South Dakota to help him get hospice set up. And it was a quiet Thursday afternoon, and I'm with my dad in the living room of his home, and he starts transitioning. Mm. And he starts describing for me the colors that he's seen. And he says, I see blue and red and orange and green, and there are trees and leaves and flowers. And I said, oh, Dad, that sounds beautiful. And he said, it is, but it's bizarre. you know the critical thinker my dad was, Lori. Right. And in that moment, what I imagined was the Garden of Eden. We ended up naming our daughter Eden in light of this experience. But what happened in that moment was, with one hand, I'm holding my dad's fingers as he's seeing glimpses of heaven and taking his last breaths here. And then with my other hand, I'm holding this pregnant belly where new life is literally kicking inside of me. And it was this experience of death and life held tandem in such a tangible, physical way. Mm-hmm. And following my dad's death, my uncle, his brother, commissioned a choral piece in remembrance of my dad, and he asked me to write the text for the piece and to make it a prayer that my dad might offer. And I ended up titling the piece Ash and Starlight, because within the first stanza of the piece is this line about the ash in my mouth and the starlight in my bones weave together in wholeness. And it alludes to the poetry at the very beginning of Scripture in Genesis, where God is creating the world and creating humankind. And the text says that God takes the dust and the ash of the earth, and then God blows this divine breath into the human, the same force that created these transcendent and pure and powerful stars beyond us. And then humans become this seamless entity that contains the dust and the ash as well as the starlight. And it's woven together in one complete thing. And it reminded me of this experience of holding my dad's hand and feeling my baby, and how we are made of earth and we are made of heaven, and that this is true too of our lives, that we have our greatest sorrow and our most ecstatic joy that can be held together at the same time in this strange way. And yet that is the way we were created to be and what we were created to hold. And that it really ties too to my theology of how I understand God, that God is a both and creator, not an either or that's separating things, but that God is bringing things together. And so with the title being Ash and Starlight, my hope in this book is to help people find wholeness and connection in their own lives and in their own hearts and in the places where it's hard to put things together. It's hard to put the grace and the chaos together.
Are you grateful? And that moment, and there's, you know, a million moments with your dad and now with your daughter, but that moment had to be life-changing for all three of you.
Yes.
Even though you're the one who's holding the story of it.
Yes.
Tom doesn't have that story. Eden has that story through you. Do we all have those moments of where we're in those thin places if we stop? And how do you encourage people to not be overwhelmed? You know, how do you process something that huge? I guess that's my question. How did you come to process something that huge and become the keeper of that story in your life instead of just being sort of, you know, steamrolled by that moment?
Right. Oh, well, I love that you brought up the thin place, thin place term, Laurie, because from the Celtic spirituality, it's that idea that heaven and earth, there's just this paper-thin veil between them, and that we're experiencing that more than we realize. Some people think of these as goosebump-type moments. But getting to your question about, being steamrolled by the overwhelming emotion, especially when it's very, very painful, I think that it's an invitation, right? I mean, pain can be a time when we shut down, when we block, when we numb it out. And there's plenty of times when I've done that myself in my life and still do. And then there's another way to see pain as an invitation to wake up and to feel. And, you know, I didn't write about all of this right away. I didn't try and make meaning of this right away. I think the best gift we can give ourselves is to simply hold it and to be awake to the experience and to name the things that we're feeling, and that story will come later. But for now, just holding the emotion and not trying to push it away, I guess, as tempting as that is the gift that you give yourself in these experiences.
Tell me about this beautiful cover, because listeners can't see it, but it is a beautiful illustration by an artist that you admired and has a great backstory. Tell us a little bit about how this cover came to be.
Yes. Well, years ago, a dear friend of mine gave me this gorgeous print of a girl's shoes standing with a very starry shadow, and underneath was a Mary Oliver quote, which I'm a huge Mary Oliver fan. Her poetry has heavily influenced my own prayer writing. But over the years, I'd had this dream that, especially when this book contract came, that maybe is there any way that Penelope, the artist is Penelope Dulligan, that she could create a cover for this book. And I knew it was just a dream because Penelope is a well-known artist and done incredible work for Oprah and other places. But I, when given the opportunity, really an unexpected opportunity from my publisher to have some say in the cover, I decided on a lark to send Penelope an email and ask her if she would be open to designing the cover of my book. And of course, she was backed out with assignments for months and months and months. And even as she said she would love to, the timing was not going to work. And I was crestfallen and took a picture of this favorite print in my home and sent it to my publisher and said, well, we can't have Penelope, but this is the type of artist I'm looking for. And I get this response from my publisher saying, do you realize that this print is actually perfect for Ash and Starlight? And I looked at it, and it was just this incredible light bulb moment. And I wrote Penelope back with asking her, is there any way you can make this the cover of my book? And she said yes. And so literally one of my favorite pieces of art in our home became the cover of Ash and Starlight. And I've told people this funny story. I had a friend over at our house the other day who didn't know this story about the cover and saw the print hanging up in our dining room and said, wow, you already got the cover of your book framed.
Little did they know. And it shares this connection with Mary Oliver, too.
Yes.
So many people connect with her work. I think so many readers are going to connect with your work. There's a deep connection with Mary Oliver that people have. What is it about her poetry to you that is that touchstone? Because once you fall in love with Mary Oliver, you really never, you know, she becomes part of your life in this really interesting,
yes.
I'm not sure there's another, I mean, I'm sure there's other poets, but I can't think of another poet right now who has that same kind of impact. When people come into this space and say they love Mary Oliver, like their entire countenance changes. You can see that not only do they love her work, but they have been changed by her work.
Right. Well, Mary Oliver is just a model for me in how to pay attention. Yeah. I mean, she uses those exact words in so many of her poems about instructions for living a life. Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that the world is marvelous and there's so much to take in and that begs for our awe and our wonder. And we can so easily lose that because there are so many things clamoring for our attention and we become distracted and we lose touch with what is really around us and lose touch with being present. And I think that is the gift that Mary Oliver gives so many of us and that her poetry gives us is to really pay attention to be where we are. And I'm a big believer. I think I heard once this quote that we become what we pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that, you know, what we pay attention to is what receives our power, right? And so Mary Oliver and her work, yeah, it is life-changing because it's such a gift what she's offering us.
In that vein, when I think of Ash and Starlight and spending time with it in a devotional context, in a prayer context, and as it fuels your own writing, it would become what you pay attention to. Talk a little bit about going deeper into your own heart to find the heart of God. You mentioned that a little bit in the book, and expand on that sort of theologically for me.
Right. Well, I guess getting back to that creation poetry, this idea that God breathes God's own spirit and life and breath into us. And so I believe that we have the Spirit of God, we have the life force and the heart of God within us. And so the deeper we go into our own hearts, I believe the deeper we go into God's. And I use this term especially in the introduction of pilgrimage, because a pilgrimage is basically a journey to a sacred place. And I think with a lot of faith traditions, there are physical pilgrimages that people can take to holy sites. But I think there is this personal pilgrimage that we take spiritually every day where we can journey into our own hearts. And by that, I mean go into what you're feeling, go into what you're thinking about, go into what you're experiencing, and find in that God's heart as well. I think that there's always this conversation happening inside of our hearts, whether we're paying attention to it or not. And prayer and paying attention is an opportunity to become aware of that and to engage in that. It's both listening and receiving as well as it is expressing and sharing.
At the very end of this book, or near the end of this book, you have copied an email from your father, Dr. Tom Braithwaite, with sort of his philosophy of prayer. And having lost my own father, I have his letters from when I was younger and I was away. But I have no emails because, you know, and I just was thinking about what a delight. Do you have many emails from your dad? Do you have many ways to sort of remember some of his thoughts and his messages to you?
I do. I mean, the gift of modern technology, really, Lori. I mean, yes, I do. I do have a number of emails from him, and he was a beautiful writer and expressed himself in amazing ways. And so I'm very grateful to have his words and to have some recordings too of his voice singing.
Yeah. He was a remarkable singer, yeah.
Right. So that is such a gift.
The five stages of grief, as they have become known, were never intended to be prescriptive or orderly. Grief expert David Kessler co-authored the books On Grief and Grieving and Life Lessons with grief research pioneer Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. He's the founder of the website grief.com, and he now has a new book. It's called Finding Meaning, the Sixth Stage of Grief. David Kessler's own experience with grief is profoundly personal. He writes about the death of his son in the book, even as he shares stories of others who have found meaning in loss without marginalizing loss in a myriad of ways.
From Los Angeles, California, David Kessler, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm sure you have heard this as you've done other interviews, but just the process for me of reading this book was incredibly, there were some tears, there's some tears on the pages, and I kind of became aware of how much unprocessed grief I have. Are we all just walking around with piles and piles of unprocessed grief?
So many of us have those tears that have not been shed and, you know, emotions that are half felt. So I'm sorry and glad that that was your experience. I think part of the work of grief is to help us grieve fully and then live fully. So my hope is, even though some of those emotions might have been challenging, that they will help you live more fully now.
It felt incredibly good. And I want to talk to you a minute about that witnessing other people's grief and the value of that. But let's go back to these stages of grief not being prescriptive, because the five stages of grief are often misunderstood, or people talk about them in ways that you never really intended. Tell us about that, please.
Sure. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross first described those stages, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, around people who were dying in her book On Death and Dying in 1969. And it was in 2000s that her and I adapted them for grief. Our world is a, you know, we want five easy steps for everything. And the good thing about them is it makes us feel like, oh, grief is not so unknown. But I can tell you, Elizabeth was a very organic, rule-breaking, messy person that would hate that in some ways things have tried to, you know, her grief's been neatened into five easy stages. And anyone who's gone through grief knows they're not five easy stages. And there's a lot of other emotions besides those. And I think for me, acceptance took on a finality in grief that her and I never intended. It was never meant to be sort of an ending to your grief.
Right. You have said that writing this book is part of a return for life to you after the death of your own son. You don't make that journey alone. How has it been for you today and, you know, at the release of the book, having so many conversations about his life? Does it feel validating that now, you know, we know his name and we know his story, we know what kind of person he was and how much you loved him? Or is it incredibly painful? Talk about coming back to life a little bit through the writing of this book, if you would, please.
Sure. Well, that was the reason, you know, I have so many stories about people who have had a spouse that have died, a sibling that have died, a parent that died, a child, even our pets. And for me, it was a journey I wanted to take because I didn't want his death to be all there was. I wanted to find meaning for myself and bring it to other people. And so that's what I hope this journey would be. And it's been all of those things you've said. It is what we're all trying to do. We're all trying to grieve and experience the loss, the pain that's there because of how much we love them. And at the same time, struggle with how can we now live fully a life that honors them and remembers them and understands if their life was precious, so is ours, and for us to continue for those around us and ourselves.
So many times in reading this book, there's so many stories of different ways people have found meaning. So let's talk a little bit about meaning. But first, one of the things I was just astonished by the human spirit and the things that human beings go through, the kinds of losses that we endure and what we do, you know, during those times and after those times. Tell us a little bit about your work in the world, because you have been part of so many people's grief journeys after emergencies, after terrorist attacks, after, you know, someone moving into your house to live their final days in hospice and working with them. Why do you keep doing the work that you do?
Well, you know, I often think people who do this work, you don't choose it, it chooses you. And I, you know, had a mother when I was 13 that had a very sterile hospital death. At the same time, there was one of the first mass shootings. And even as a young boy, I knew there was a better way to do the end of life and to deal with grief. And in some ways, I hope all those things I become, whether it's working with the police or the Red Cross or hospice and palliative care, that we're able to find meaning by changing things for others. And it's easy in this world to discuss post-traumatic stress, but I wanted people to know that post-traumatic growth is out there and actually occurs more frequently.
Not many people are saying that message right now, I can tell you, with a fair amount of confidence.
That's part of my work. That's part of my work.
And you talk about witnessing, or, you know, sort of coming alongside somebody in this chapter called Grief Must Be Witnessed. And I want to get at this idea so that people are not misinformed, that witnessing the grief and talking about meaning should no way ever marginalize, you know, hey, let's find meaning in this, or that there's the good can come from this, and which is a trap that so many people who have experienced loss end up hearing when people don't know what to say.
Right. And meaning does not take away the pain. The pain is part of your love. There's no taking away the pain. But what we sometimes do is we sometimes see our friends and loved ones in grief and we try to fix them, or point out the silver lining, or cheer them up, or tell them, isn't it good they died quickly, or they lived to an old age, or you can get remarried, or have another child, and all those things we just say out of being grief illiterate. And the point really is to witness their grief, just to go, I can't make this better, I don't even have the right words, but I'm here with you through this.
Yeah.
And just to be a witness and bear witness to their sorrow without trying to fix them.
Why is that so hard for us?
because we are such a fix-it productive society now. Yeah. We're like, let's do this. Let's get it better. Let's fix it. What do we need to do? What are the five things we need to do in grief? Let's get that handled.
Yeah.
And, you know, grief is not about doing. Grief is about us being. And we are supposed to stop and slow down and get that grief turns our world upside down. And it's supposed to. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, I tell people we come from a long lineage of dead people. Our ancestors knew how to do this.
Yeah.
In a strange way, I'm teaching people what our great-grandparents knew how to do. How to just be with these feelings without trying to fix them.
Yeah. Part of it, too, has to be that that productivity is expected. Talk to people who haven't been, you know, maybe they knew that they needed time to, you know, go to a funeral. They needed time to stay home and cry after the loss of a dog, maybe, and weren't given that because there was a job to be done. There was something that needed to be done at work or their parents or just life, you know, they had to go renew their driver's license the next day, pay their bills. Where do you begin if that grief is really not welcomed or allowed at work, in your family, in the culture that you live in? How do you find that space when you know that you need it?
Well, a couple of things. The first thing is to know it's your job to honor your own grief. And what other people think about it is really none of your business. So they don't know the relationship you had. They don't know the loss you had. And just know that the reality is you do, and you have to honor it. That's your work. And the truth is, grief doesn't need tons of time. It needs dedicated time. So, of course, we all have to go to work. We all have to get gas and get groceries and all those things. But it doesn't mean we can't dedicate our shower in the morning to just crying for them or taking a walk at lunch around the block alone, listening to their favorite music and just giving that grief just a few minutes.
Hmm. How is meaning different for different people? You have stories of people who have, you know, begun foundations and done enormous things to change the lives of others, and then meaning that is expressed in these very quiet, delicate ways as well.
Well, and that's so important. When we hear about meaning, we think about, oh, this gigantic thing we're all going to find. We're going to start organizations and foundations. And the reality is just that part of us that can take moments, meaningful moments. I tell the story in the book of a woman who gets stamps about Danny Thomas that reminds her of her father. And just in her daily work, once in a while, she pulls out a stamp and has a moment of thinking about her dad. It's in the moments of life. And one of the confusing things I want people to know, besides that meaning and that sixth stage of meaning doesn't take away the pain, that it's there in addition to it. It's also something that lives within us. It's not meaning in their death. There is no meaning in how they died or why they died. But there's meaning afterwards. How did they change us? You know, people often say to me, a part of me died with them. And I'll remind them, a part of them also lives in you. Mm-hmm. How do we nurture that part that we take of them into the world?
For people who order this book on your website, I'm sorry, I just lost your website, grief.com.
Grief.com.
Yeah, they can. There's more material to sort of help people engage in the process, you know, beyond reading the book. Tell me a little bit about some of those first steps to take and what sort of resources are available for people who are listening right now and say, yeah, I need more of this. I need some help moving through it.
Right. So people have been through horrible things in this world, and it's not like a quick, easy read a book.
Right.
So I also did a free companion class for anyone who buys the book, anywhere, their local bookstore, online, wherever. They can go to sixthstage.com, S-I-X-T-H, stage.com, or they'll also see it on grief.com. Get the book, take the free class, work through it. It's so much to do, but at the end, it will help you have a life that's worth living and honors your loved ones who have died.
Talk a little bit, if you will, about those complicated relationships, because there are so many. When you lose somebody who you had a loving, you know, rainbow relationship with, it can mean you grieve in a different way than if that person that you lost, you had unfinished business, or they were not the parent that you wanted them to be, or there's something else going on there. Tell us a little bit about those complicated relationships that we also grieve.
Yeah, let's be real. How many of us have those rainbow relationships? You know, people are complicated. And we have this idea that when people are dying, everything's going to get rosy and get resolved. But the truth is we die in the middle of arguments. Yeah. We die in the middle of estrangement. We die in the middle of complicated relationships. And even when we're talking about other things like death and other losses, I tell people, divorce, you know, divorce is the death of a relationship. A job loss is the death of your job. So life is complicated. And this idea that we notion that we have of it's all going to get cleaned up is just not true. So part of our work is to grieve the relationship, the parent, the spouse, the loved one, as they were. And sometimes we also have to grieve the ideal parent or ideal spouse or ideal person we didn't get this lifetime. Because we all don't get those rainbow relationships. They're pretty imperfect, and so are we. But if we grieve them as is with their good and their bad parts, I mean, think about whenever you come from a funeral that you just feel so touched by, it's because the funeral represented that person and connected you. We've all been to funerals where the clergy maybe didn't know the person and they describe someone who is just amazing. And you're like, well, it's a beautiful funeral. It wasn't Frank's, but it was beautiful. So, we actually grieve better in our authenticity than when we go, oh, they were an ideal person. They were a human.
And so are we.
Authors Rosemary Ross and Mary Angela joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh in the Sioux Falls studio ahead of a November 30th presentation at the downtown branch of the Siouxland Libraries. You can see them from 3 until 4 p.m. this Saturday. Mary Angela's new release is called Coming Up Murder. Set in the fictional town of Copper Bluff, South Dakota, Professor Emmeline Prather is set to take in the delights of a Shakespeare festival in her quaint college town. But a graduate student shakes up the spotlight with accusations about the bard's true identity. Who might have been upset enough at his revelations to want him silenced permanently? Rosemary Ross introduces a new detective in Cobblered to Death. Courtney Archer plays the quintessential farmer's daughter on her popular cooking show. But the weight of her urban upbringing means she has to hide who she really is from her fans. The chance to film a high-stakes cooking competition brings hope for a new, more authentic persona. But when one of the contestants is bludgeoned by her own cast-iron pan, bubbling with cherry cobbler, Courtney goes from star of the show to person of interest. Can Courtney clear her name by figuring out the drama on camera and behind the scenes? Or will her curiosity end her career and her life? Here's Lori with the two authors.
Mary Angela and Rosemary Ross, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
What a fun, a delightful read these both were for me. So let's talk a little bit about what a cozy mystery is in the first place. Is that a descriptor that, you know, how can kind of people get their minds around this notion of cozy mystery? Mary?
A cozy mystery is a classic whodunit. And so there isn't a lot of graphic violence. The murder takes place off camera, and there isn't a lot of swearing in Cozy Mysteries or any of that. And so really the primary focus is just the mystery itself. You might have some subplots or some romance, but it's basically the question is who committed the act of murder or who committed the crime or whatever it may be in the plot. So that's basically the focus of the Cozy Mysteries. And sometimes there might be a craft associated with it or a recipe or some other theme that it...
You get to do whatever you want.
Right.
But we as readers like to go, and so there's a sense to it that just says, okay, I'm not going to be too traumatized by some graphic, gory violence. Maybe is that kind of, Rosemary, how you sort of see from a reader's perspective?
Yes. Yeah. There's no graphic, and usually the sleuth is an amateur sleuth.
Okay.
They're not a trained professional. Now, there are some where they're private eyes, but most of the time in Cozy Mysteries, it's an amateur sleuth that needs to clear their name, and then from there, they just are always involved in the mystery and trying to get down to what actually happened and not the topical explanation what happened.
Which kind of makes it feel like it's every man. It's all of us.
Right.
It's the sort of things that we start trying to figure out and then get ourselves in too deep, but we don't really in real life because it would actually be dangerous.
Right. We would probably be arrested.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about these books and some of the settings that you chose, because Mary, I mean, this is a very familiar setting to people in South Dakota. There's a whole lot of nods to a certain South Dakota college town.
There is. You noticed that. Yeah, definitely. Copper Bluff is a fictional town in South Dakota, but I'm thrilled to have this series set in South Dakota, and actually my next series is also set in South Dakota. But it's based a lot on my own time in Vermilion, South Dakota, and my time at the University of South Dakota. And so a lot of that setting is drawn from my time there on campus.
There is a Shakespeare Garden. The First Folio comes to town. There's a Shakespeare Festival.
Yes.
They go to a bar called Harry's. And there's a music museum, a Harmony Music Museum.
Yes, yes. Lots of similarities.
Yeah. That feels really validating, though,
yeah,
when you're from South Dakota, to sort of have that inside track, too, and certainly helped me visualize the Shakespeare Garden.
Right, right. No, I think it's so much fun because you do see some of those familiar sites that are based on USD. But I've also had people from Augustana and from SDSU tell me, have thought that it was based on their town too. So I think that a lot of it, anybody who went to a small college campus might be able to see themselves, you know, there.
Right. And there's a lot of academic intrigue as well, in the sense that this is a woman who has a career, who has career challenges, who has relationship challenges, who has neighbors, who has... A mystery isn't worth its weight unless there's a great character driving the story. Tell us a little bit about Emmeline.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that mysteries, they're all about plot and whodunit, but you need to have that character arc, especially in a series where they're changing and growing, and Emmeline is... such a neat character to me because she's a little bit of a romantic. She's kind of quirky. She's really smart. She's just like so many professors I had the privilege to study under, honestly, because a lot of people will ask me to, you know, Emmeline, who is she? Where did you come up with this character idea? And really, she is such a compilation of those neat, fun professors that I had the privilege of working under and just had a wonderful time at USD. So she's kind of a combination of that.
She's not afraid to wear some kicky shoes.
No, yeah. She likes her shoes and she'll look at her older professors and see all the things that they're doing or wearing and their sort of tattered jackets or blazers with the elbow patches and things, and she's got her little cheetah sandals on and she knows this is different and she's a little bit younger than some of her colleagues, but it makes it fun because she admires those.
She's uniquely herself in this world, kind of navigating it. And Rosemary, tell me about Courtney Archer, because she's, she's taking on a persona, but she's really an interesting person without that persona as well, especially because I love this little
it's not a quirk. It's this passion that she has of carving fruit into objects, which she never gets to show to the world because that's not the farmer's daughter kind of thing to do. How does she end up, how does Courtney Archer end up being the farmer's daughter and having to really hide her actual upbringing?
Well, what happened for her is when she graduated culinary school, the job that she got out of school was for a grocery store chain where she went around making food using whatever they had on sale because that was her job. And that's where producer Eric Iverson discovered her. And the show that he pitched to the network was A Farmer's Daughter. They needed to fill a spot. So then she couldn't use her chef skills like food carving because she was known as a persona. That's what sold the show, was the persona of the farmer's daughter to fill a demographic.
Yeah. There's so much in both of these books. I want to talk about Courtney for a little bit, where women get put in, they're in a profession and their expectations of that profession, that these women are either, you know, celebrating and all in for or kind of rallying against and trying to figure out how to be their authentic selves within this profession. You know, it's obvious that we all want to go behind the scenes of a cooking show, right?
Right.
So is that what you wanted to do as an author, too, is you wanted to take people that had to be a fascinating thing to research?
I did. And, you know, headlines tell us a lot of things. There's been celebrity chefs that get in trouble because their on-air persona seems so sweet and nice and wonderful. And in their real life, they're not at all the person that they're portrayed on television. And that's where I took that idea of have her be a city girl, but she's posing as a country girl. And we all know that in our world, if you're making money, you have to keep up the front. And that's what she has to do because her show is popular and she has to keep pretending she's a farmer's daughter.
Which means she already has a secret as this sort of this murder unfolds, which makes things a little bit difficult for her to navigate because people are getting an idea that she has a secret. Talk to us about plotting. Let's talk about plotting a murder mystery and how I have no idea how to begin. Do you begin at the beginning, the end, with character? Tell us a little bit about the process of writing a mystery and crafting it.
For me, I had a book that I went by, and it showed you should do it in three acts with your first chapter as your beginning introduction and your last chapter as the wrap-up chapter where it's solved and we're moving on, and you're going to see what the character gets to do next for hopefully the next book. And so that's what I break mine down into, three acts. So the stakes have to get higher through the second act, and then you have to start wrapping it up in the third act. You have to start showing that some of those red herrings that people may have thought was clues were in fact nothing.
I know, I'm ready to slam my fist on the table and announce what some of those were. I want to ruin it. I don't want to ruin it for readers, but I will say that, I mean, I didn't think about the structure of the book while I was reading it. I was just reading for enjoyment. And now that you say that, I was almost surprised. And I was like, oh, Of course, Rosemary Ross had a structure to it, and of course, it was seamless, and I didn't see it. So, Mary, tell us a little bit about your process and weaving in those hints and clues and deceptions as well.
Mm-hmm. I always know who the killer is at the beginning of the novel, and so I have that. I also use an outline, and this is something that I probably started doing with my third book, I think. Started using an outline, and it was just because more material was becoming due at publishers, and so you have to write your synopsis and send that in. And I noticed that when I had to do that and ended up outlining the book and writing the synopsis first, it was nice having that to fall back on a little bit and have that planning done. And I ended up rewriting less because of that. So right now that's where I'm at. You know, I have that outline and I loosely outline my books before I write them. I always know who the killer is, and that's been with every book that I've ever written. But I do like to place a lot of clues throughout. I think, you know, whenever you answer one question, you sort of have to ask another question to keep the reader's interest piqued. And that's what I try to do and sprinkle those clues out so that it's not you know, so that it's possible that if a reader is paying attention, they might be able to find out who the killer is or have some ideas of who the killer is. I never want to just, you know, come out with someone at the end of the book who just you haven't seen for the last 250 pages or something like that.
Right.
So I like clues, and I like to sprinkle them out and be fair. Yeah, with the reader, too.
You must have delightful relationships with your readers because, again, I want to ruin it for anybody who's listening, but I would love to tell you right now, like, who I thought it was, you know, and why, and you'd probably look at me like, what? You know? So do you get readers who shock you that you think, well, how in the world did they get that? Because that was never your intention. As people sort of, you know, because I think when you read a mystery novel, one of the things that you might like to do is to, you know, to try to figure it out. I mean, what do you find mystery readers really, do they do that with you? Come back and say something, you know, kind of off the wall that they thought before the whodunit was revealed?
I have not had that happen. I've had some reviews.
Yet, as soon as we're off mic.
No. As soon as we're off mic. I've had some reviewers say, and one of them was a good friend of mine who writes suspense, that they had to keep paging back through the book to try to figure out who it was. Because yeah. once they thought they knew, and then it was revealed that was not the person, they were trying to go back to look for the clues to sure. find where that clue was. And I do try to be subtle and have it in some kind of just basic conversation or every, you know, kind of action or something like that. And so I've had two or three people say that they didn't know who it was until the very end and that they had to page back yeah. to try to find out where that clue was that would have told them.
And really, even if you did have an idea, it was still a pretty good read. I mean, you're still enjoying the book, and that has to be part of, you know, it's not a, you know, it's not an outline. It's a novel, and therefore it has to be well-crafted and, you know, mm-hmm. put together.
And I write for people to enjoy yeah. reading. So from what you just said, it's true. Even if you figure it out, I just want them to have a good time while they're reading. We have such a busy world that if they can just take a minute and enjoy themselves, that's all I ask.
We will take a minute to take a break, and we'll be back with more with these two South Dakota mystery authors in a moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking about two new cozy mystery stories by two wonderful South Dakota authors. We have Mary Angela and Rosemary Ross in the studio. Mary's book, which just came out in November, is called Coming Up Murder. And Rosemary Ross's Cobblered to Death is released today.
Day.
All right. There's like a couple copies at Barnes & Noble right now that you signed.
They are. That's
right.
True.
So go before they sell out right
That's
now.
That's right.
They're in their car already. They're listening to, they're having this driveway moment. They're in the parking spot at Barnes & Noble. They're going to go in and pick up a copy. I know they are. All right. Let's talk a little bit about, I want to talk with you, Rosemary, about a female friendships okay. with both of you, because that was another thing I really found in this book that, you know, she meets this friend and you see how women communicate, women connect. Is that important to you, that Courtney had a friend that she could trust? Right
yes.
Away? Yeah.
Yes, it is, because I do think women should have best friends that support each other. I've had reviewers tell me that her friend Shannon is more interesting than she is, and that is not what I intended, but I wanted to show that sometimes women can meet each other and make a connection, and they have instant support, and that Courtney actually has someone who supports her no matter what, even when she has to tell her the truth.
Right.
Because yeah. Shannon is also mistaken about Courtney's background, and that bothers Courtney a lot. So she makes the decision that the friendship is more important than the secret.
Yeah.
Spoiler. But she makes that decision, and I think that's important because I think we all have one or two people in our lives that we feel that way about.
Right. We don't know how everybody else is going to, how everything is going to fall out, but we do have a sense of security with Shannon, you know, throughout the book, I think, that, you know, was intentional, and I found kind of comforting and a place of solidness in a world that, I mean, she's taking, I mean, this is a closed set. They can't get off the premises.
Right.
There's this cooking competition going. You don't know who anybody is, if they're even who they say they are. There are facades and, you know, TV personas and, you know, somebody looks polished here and then you see him, he's all disheveled. So there's a sense of not knowing
who or what to trust, what's real and what's pretend, what food tastes good and what food doesn't. And then there's Shannon. And
right.
I really appreciated that throughout the. And then, Mary, one of the things I really gravitated to in your book, Coming Up Murder, also was this this book that Emmeline is writing and mm-hmm. how she's having her own struggles as a female academic. What can you tell us without, you know, ruining too much of just mm-hmm. of how hard it is for her to get her book in the world and not have it look like a cliche?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's something actually one of my readers wrote in a couple of years ago, and he said, don't forget about that book that she's working on, because I would like to see what happens with her press and all the struggles that occur when you try to publish a book. And that seed was planted right when I got that email, and I thought about it for many times before I wrote that kind of subplot into Coming Up Murder. But yeah, there are a lot of stereotypes that she's trying to fight against. She has, you know, her cover has, you know, some flowers on it that she doesn't want, and just some kind of cutesy things that she's, trying to fight against or really trying to
she's trying to be taken seriously,
right?
Trying,
because her subject,
yeah, yes, determined to not take her seriously.
Yes, exactly, because her subject is definitely more serious and more academic, and yet she's trying to fight against these cliches, as you said. So it was kind of a fun subplot to explore and work with in this book.
Do you find that, and you mentioned somebody sending an email to talk a little bit about your relationships with your readers, and I think especially with mystery authors, people feel like they want to give you some ideas, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, I think people like to do that anyway.
Yeah,
right.
But yes, I think they do like to give you ideas, or they tell you who their favorite character in the book, not necessarily author. A lot of times people say to me, Cozy Mystery, and I go, Murder, She Wrote. And then everyone knows what you're talking about. And then they say, I love Jessica Fletcher, because they identify with that character.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's all we can all hope for. So they will say things like, why don't you write something like that? Why don't you write something like Jessica Fletcher? And it's like, well, I'm trying.
Yeah. Maybe they haven't read the book yet when they say that. And they also have to, like, come up with, like, you know, what if this is the murder weapon, something that you have. Do you get ideas from, like, you know, crimes? Do people, like, share? Here's what I'm really getting at. Are you, like, low-key obsessed with crime as you search for your next?
You know, I'm not, like, scary crime, because it's frightening to me that people could be, as some serial killers are.
Right.
But more lightweight crime that you read about and you think, what were they thinking? You know, like the people who rob a bank, but they give a telephone number or something, and then they wonder how they got tracked down so fast.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they give their real identity, those kind of things.
Mary?
Yeah, I think you always have readers, and like the one I mentioned, you know, they'll come up with ideas, or they'll talk to you about characters. Mrs. Gunderson is sort of a side character that at the beginning of the series, she and Emmeline really had some struggles as neighbors, but by the fourth book, they're quite close, and so it's fun to see how those characters change. And but I've had people say, you should kill Mrs. Gunderson and have Em solve her murder. My daughter Maisie actually said that she thought that Emmeline should get murdered and Lenny should try to solve her death. And so, yeah,
I disagree strongly with both those sentiments. So.
Yeah, I couldn't do either of those, but
you can't kill your main character.
No, you can't. No. I don't think a publisher would
legit
go for that.
You cannot kill Mrs. Gunderson either.
But it's just so fun to think of how involved they get with your characters, just like you do. You know, coming up with ideas for what they can do. And
you talk about this a little bit with the Shakespeare connection, mm-hmm. and the tragedies that Shakespeare wrote about in his plays, and mm-hmm. and why do you know Emmeline is answering this question, which is my question for both of you, which is why are we so fascinated with murder mysteries and mm-hmm. with these life and death, you know, sort of human dramas? Why would someone do that? How do people figure it out and solve it? You know, people have been writing murder mysteries that people gobble up for a long time. You're part mm-hmm. of a pretty impressive tradition.
I think people like to solve puzzles.
Puzzles, yeah.
You know, we're curious. People are curious. And so they like to hear part of the situation and try to solve it themselves, because we all like to solve puzzles. And I think that's some of the draw to it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the amateur sleuth, too, does put you in the driver's seat. And so you get to imagine, you know, not being a professional or a PI or a officer, just being an amateur sleuth, it puts the reader right in that seat to imagine, well, what if you owned a little store, or what if you were in a baking show or were a professor and you had to solve this crime? And so I think that it's about the puzzle, like Rosemary said, but it's also about being that character for that short amount of time that you're reading and imagining yourself doing these things.
And they always just go a step too far and end up at risk themselves, which hopefully we do not do.
Right.
Yeah. Is that fun for you?
It is fun for me to put a character in danger. I would never put myself in danger. Right. I just wouldn't. It's not. Yeah. I'm a self-protective person, mm-hmm. and so it's fun to put the character in danger, but I would never want to be in her shoes.
You're so genteel. And then your eyes spark and say, I love that. Mary, do you like sort of putting her at risk a little? Because she's at risk in this book.
I do. And I like writing those scenes where she's just kind of on the edge of something, or she's at the edge of, you know, peril, and she has to figure out a way out of this. And so I love that. It keeps it interesting while you're writing, and, you know, interesting for the readers, too, as they read.
I love that in both stories, you know, as they go through these sort of traumatic events in their lives, you know, that they both are connected and have romantic feelings for someone else, because that would not be me. there's no way I'd be looking at any, you know, romance during, you know, fear that I'm going to get murdered.
But it is a popular theme in cozy mysteries, though, to have more than one romantic interest, so that there's a love triangle.
As a reader, I found it, you know, comforting, and again, another, you know, to pull you through in the plot. As a person, I'd have left that show. Nobody would have been able to stop. Did you research behind the scenes and how cooking shows work?
I did. I did internet research on it. I found interviews with contestants who had been on baking competitions. And because they're weekly shows, you think they're done weekly, and they're not. They're shot in sequence. So they may be on the set for 2 weeks or however long it takes them to either continue on or be taken off, but it's all shot in a 2 week time frame, most of them. Mm-hmm. Even some of the weekly shows are shot more segments than a weekly segment. So,
all right, tell us a little bit about Saturday's event at the library.
Well, we are going to be talking to Jane Healy, our wonderful downtown librarian, about our books. She's going to be interviewing both of us and just talking a little bit about them, and then we'll have the opportunity to, our readers will have the opportunity to purchase books and have them signed, and Zambrose will be down there to coordinate that.
Right. Yeah. And there will be a question and answer time for the audience to ask us, whether they're readers or writers. It's a good opportunity for either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, Zambrose will be selling books, and everybody needs to remember it's Small Business Saturday.
That's a
good way to support a small business.
And tell us a little bit for the writers, other people who want to get involved in writing mysteries, what is some of your top advice?
You need to educate yourself on the genre you want to write, by reading books, by taking online courses or in-person courses if someone offers them near you, and believe what people are telling you, and you have to persevere. Mm. Publishing is a tough business.
And that's coming from someone who's cracked it. We could talk for about, you know, 5 minutes about how many books and articles and things that you have published in different genres. You know how to do it, and even you say it is tough,
and be persistent.
Mary, some of the best advice for wannabe mystery authors.
I think, too, learning about the business of publishing, just by joining organizations like Mystery Writers of America or Authors Guild, any of those organizations where you can learn from people who do have experience before you go out there and try it on your own.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of the segments at listen.sdpb.org and on our daily podcast, In the Moment Segments. The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow Lori on Twitter at MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Chris Lawfrey. Thanks for listening.